Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. New home construction in November was up 9% over October, and the index of leading economic indicators is up for the eighth month in a row. Republican leaders praise Obama's wisdom in handling the economy. Okay, that last one's a joke. But this isn't a joke. A German study reported in the New England Journal of Medicine that men who stare at women's breasts for 10 minutes a day live 5 years longer. It's amazing my dad didn't live to be 100. And did you ever wonder who funds these things? The Senate bill on health care financing doesn't have a single payer, a public option, or a Medicare buy-in for those between 55 and 65. This is what success is supposed to look like. At least one prominent Democrat suggests killing the bill. A cluster of cases of male pseudo-hermaphroditism occurs in Gaza. We'll explain why Arkansas may be next. Tiger Woods, as you may have heard, has decided not to play professional golf for an indefinite period. The good news is he's still working out. He's hiking along the Appalachian Trail. Same-sex marriage is to be legalized in the District of Columbia. Former Congressman Mark Foley and current Senator Larry Craig proclaimed the city council's decision as fabulous. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. All that, news of the weird, and a special guest, Dr. Santos Vega, who's written a novel based on an actual family experience of forced repatriation to Mexico of American citizens. We'll talk about his novel, his family's experience, his writing, and the publication of the book and related issues. We'll have a program note about the next 2 weeks, and we will also have an endpoint essay. This hour is going to seem fairly short, I'm afraid. Let me talk to you about the program notes. First off, for those of you who were listening last week, we had some extreme technical difficulties. The website at Blog Talk Radio, I'm not finding fault, and I'm only criticizing out of love, but the website kept kicking us off, kept kicking me off, and it wasn't even a matter of a sudden attack of good taste. It was just a technical problem, and so we ended the show early. I'm told it was about 30 minutes by the time we went off, but we probably had about 20 minutes or 15 minutes of content because of all of that. We kept getting knocked off and calling back in, and to make a long story short, too late for that, you say? All right. That show didn't last very long. So if you're going to sample shows that we've done, and this is the first one you're listening to live, do me a favor and don't listen to last week's. That's about the previous show. Our next shows, next week is December 24th, and it's Christmas Eve, and we will be here. And the guest I had last week, my lovely bride, Alicia, will be with us on the 24th as well, talking about a variety of things that I expect those of you who listen will find interesting. For those of you who don't have a life or Christmas Eve to spend with your family, but seriously, those of you who listen next week, and for those who listen in archive form afterwards, which you can do, by the way, by going to the same site as you visit to listen to this show. We'll be discussing simplified life. We may touch again on vegetarianism, which we spoke of last week, and other matters that I think you'll find interesting and informative. The informative part will be from her. The interesting part, hopefully, will be from both of us, but you can make that judgment on your own. And the week after that, however, is New Year's Eve, and though, frankly, we won't be doing anything like going out and celebrating the incoming year and that sort of thing, we will nevertheless be off the air that night. We will not be doing a program, so we will be gone New Year's Eve, but we'll be returning on January 7th, and that's the situation there. Talking about some of these stories that are in the news will occur in a moment, but I first wanted to tell you that the phone number, if you'd like to call in and participate in this GabFest, and at the very least, that way you won't have to listen to my voice until Dr. Santos arrives, Dr. Vega, rather, you can call us at area code 347 994-3796. We'll try to get you on as soon as possible so you don't have to be on hold for a long time. If you'd rather just sit back and listen, that's fine too. But again, if you do want to join, it's 347-994-3796. One last thing before we talk about the news stories is to mention to you that if you live in the Phoenix metro area, I have a phone number I'll be giving to you in just a moment, which will enable you to get free things for your pet animals, for your animal children. I'll give you that number, and that will allow you to get in touch with us and set up a get-together, or as they sometimes call them, a pawty, P-A-W-T-Y. And whether you have a dog or a cat or a bird or just about any kind of pet, you'll be able to get free things for your animal, and you'll also be able to let your guests know at the get-together that they can get an extra 10% off in January and February. So if you're in the Phoenix metro area, you can call us, not now, but after the show, or tomorrow, or the next day, at 480-628-9786. Repeating that number, 480-628-9786. And if you're outside the metro Phoenix area, while you're still welcome to call when we're off, you can also just go visit us on the web. And you do that by going to petlane.com/Bushman, B-U-S-H-M-A-N. And now we're back. New home construction I mentioned is considered a very good sign by economists. The reason for that is that the two leading industries in this country, which help determine what occurs in the economy broadly, are, class, anyone? Okay. It's construction, and housing in particular, and automobiles. Obviously, the car business is still not recovered, but the construction industry is doing better. Part of that has to do with tax credits. Part of it has to do with the fact that people are interested now in buying houses more than they were before. Still not up to where it was or where it needs to be, but there is an improvement. And the reason that the housing industry is so important to the economy is severalfold. One, of course, is construction jobs. There are not enough blue-collar jobs in America relative to the number of workers who are there to fill it. That's obviously why you have unemployment, but also a number of the blue-collar jobs have left the country. A lot of that work is now being done overseas. And speaking of that, I do have a book to recommend to you. If you want to read about that and why that's not such a bad thing, of course, unless you've lost your job and are a blue-collar worker, you might wish to read a book by Robert Reich, R-E-I-C-H, who used to be the labor secretary in the Clinton administration and is also a professor of economics. The book is called The Work of Nations, and it was published a few years ago and really describes how that kind of situation where each country does what it's best at, if you'll forgive the syntax, really works out for everybody, although there are clearly some dislocations and temporary problems with that. But it's a book that's well written, it's not terribly dense, and really covers that. But the home construction industry also contributes mightily to the fact that other things happen when home construction is up. Besides the jobs and allowing people who are working in construction to then spend money and buy products and create other jobs, not unimportant, is the fact that when someone buys a new house, they very seldom move all of their old furniture into the new house. The one thing that will determine how well furniture dealers do is how much new home construction there is. Likewise, other things that you would buy for the home, carpeting, drapes, all of that, is determined by the amount of new home construction in the country. So the fact that it's up 9% over the previous month is a very, very good thing. Also, the leading economic indicators, this is a number of statistics that they measure each month to determine what's likely to happen in the economy in the near to medium term future. And this was up again for the eighth month in a row, and that's a good thing, as Martha Stewart might say. The healthcare financing reform bills, The House passed one that was not bad. The Senate is having trouble passing one. And with every passing day, the Democrats are compromising more and more benefits to the program away because they can't get 60 votes to beat a filibuster, which would be led by Republicans and joined in by Joe Lieberman. That may sound silly when you realize that as a practical matter, Lieberman is a Republican, but that he is nominally an independent who caucuses with the Democrats for reasons I don't fully understand. That said, in order to get past Lieberman and avoid a filibuster, they've had to get rid of first the public option and now the Medicare buy-in they had for Americans who were not 65 but were between 55 and 65. They've gotten rid of that as well. Howard Dean, the former candidate for the Democratic nomination back in 2004, I beg your pardon, has said that he thinks that the Senate bill ought to be killed and that it be started over again at a later point. Dean is a very bright man, former governor of Vermont, a physician, very interested in healthcare, has written a book on the need for public health that is a single payer and the other things that could happen to help reform healthcare. Very bright guy, I just don't agree with him. And the reason I don't agree with him is more political than practical. And that would be that if you go ahead and kill the bill, between now and the election in 2010, there will not be a Republican in America who doesn't talk about the fact that they defeated the Democratic attempt to impose government-controlled health care on the United States. Big mistake. It is always likely that the party in power will lose seats in the House and the Senate during the midterm elections, such as 2010. That will virtually assure it, and it'll make it much worse. The other thing we talked about that deserves some more time is the cluster of cases of male, I'm going to do this right this time, pseudohermaphroditism. And here's what that is. It's a very weird story. In Gaza, which is in the Palestinian area, it's not in Palestine as such because there's no actual nation-state called Palestine at this point, but in the occupied Palestinian area of Gaza. What male pseudo-hermaphroditism is where a child is born, and because the male genitalia don't manifest themselves, don't come down, if you will, the doctor assumes that the baby is a girl. The child is treated as a girl, is dressed as a girl, perfectly reasonable assumption, but that occurs. And then at some later point, usually around puberty, this child starts growing facial hair and having a lower voice and being interested in girls, presumably, or at least most of the time, and all of that. And they then realize that the male stuff has been hidden up in the cavity above where it normally sits. And, of course, then they can do surgery and all that. And then they start treating the kid, the teenager, as a boy. And he really is a boy. And and at that point, they really begin to feel normal when all that time prior they had felt that perhaps there was something wrong, although they might not have been able to identify it. So a lot of this has happened in the Gaza Strip area. And when analyzing what the problem is, the doctor who has been talking about having discovered so many cases, there are a lot of it within families and even outside of those, you know, the same family, it's just been occurring a lot. The doctor has said that, and this is why I made the joke about Arkansas maybe next, is that it involves a lot of inbreeding within the family. In Gaza, there are a lot of situations where when someone gets married, they want to marry a cousin. And there you go. there was an old joke, I don't remember it, unfortunately, and I'm going to kill the humor in it, but there was an old joke about Arkansas is the one state in the country, forgive me if you're in Arkansas, where you go to a family reunion to see who your next date might be. Something like that, I don't know. We also wanted to tell you about some news of the weird, as it were. Some news that's been reported recently, And before we do that, I want, and we will do that, I wanted to remind you that in about 10 or 15 minutes, we'll be joined by Dr. Santos Vega, an author of the book, The Worm in My Tomato. And the book is much more serious than the than the humorous title, although I'm sure there's humor in the book. But it talks about in a novelistic form, a bit of his family history, which was somewhat difficult, and he'll tell us more about that. But first, whether you have one or more children in your home, I'll bet you have at least one child who lives with you, and these days they're called pets. I talked about it before, I just wanted to mention again that if you go to petlane.com/bushman, you'll find out about PetLane and about how you can obtain really high-quality products for your pet child, and at the same time be able to share that with your friends and your associates and getting discounts on products for them too. In January and February, it's an extra 10% off the price of the product, so please go to petlane.com/bushman, or as said before, if you live in the Phoenix metro area, it's 480-628-9786. We talked about sharing news of the weird with you, and here's a couple of stories. A marathoner named Jerry Johncock was 81 years old and was four-fifths of the way through the Twin Cities Marathon in October when he was overtaken by a medical problem common to men of his age, urinary blockage. I should tell you, for those who don't know, a marathon is 26.2 miles. As he stopped to discuss his plight with officials, noting that he would have to quit the race to get to a hospital before his bladder burst, a spectator of the race overheard the conversation and offered him the use of a spare catheter he had in his car. John Cock, his real name, repaired to a restroom, administered the catheter, and returned to finish the race. And that story was reported in October. I also want to recommend to you the website, News of the Weird. It's newsoftheweird.com, and if you go through that site, you'll read this kind of story. There's a great many of them. We can only report on a few of them. Some very funny stuff. As a side note, your faithful reporter ran a half marathon this last weekend and didn't have the problem that Mr. Johncock did, I'm happy to say. Another story, Lisa Blair and her six sisters were enjoying a Thanksgiving meal in Hamilton, Ontario, when they began noticing suspicious flecks in the food and realized that their necklace lockets containing the ashes of their mother, who had passed away a couple of weeks before that, were leaking. Fortunately, a local funeral services store restocked and sealed the lockets. Okay, I'm going to give you our phone number again after that one. It is 347-994-3796. And you can join us if you will, if you have anything you'd like to discuss in the world of politics or books. And speaking of books, I want to do another little commercial message, invite you to visit tinyurl.com/mobilemillionaire. I'm the author of the book. It's about 207 pages, and will describe for you the process of being a small investor and investing in mobile homes for the purpose of profit, obviously, and income flow. And just as an aside, you don't have to have a lot of money to invest in mobile homes in most communities across America. And it is something that can put you in a position where it could help you in your ultimate retirement, something for you to consider. The book also outlines, by the way, how you can legitimately and legally use your retirement account to buy those mobile homes and establish an income for your retirement account so that it builds up a little faster. Anyway, something to think about if you are interested. It's tinyurl.com/mobilemillionaire. We spoke earlier of the decision by the Washington, D.C. City Council to legalize same-sex marriage. A bill had to be passed twice, as, according to their rules, in order to be sent to the mayor of the District of Columbia, and it is now passed a second time. All that's necessary to bring it into law, bring it into effect, is the signature of the mayor, and he's already said that he's going to sign the bill. Now, the only way that that law could thereafter be upset, I mean, barring a court challenge that in some fashion rules it unconstitutional or something, the only way that law could be upset is that because the District of Columbia is a what's called a federal enclave, the Congress could, within 30 days, vote to overturn that law. It's the only place in the United States where that's true, within the continental United States anyway. There may be some territory where that would also apply. But in order for Congress to do it, they would have to bring forth a bill and it would have to pass by majority vote. And since the Congress is controlled by the Democrats, that's obviously unlikely to happen. We have a caller on the line, and let's see what she or he has to say. Just one second, we'll see about that. Let's see if we can get him on the air. Okay, it's working. Hello, who am I speaking with?
I believe you're speaking to me, Jeff Santos Vega.
Oh, good. I'm glad you joined us early. Good. Terrific. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm sorry,
okay.
I'm early. Yeah.
No, I'm thrilled that you're early.
Okay.
And we can let me go ahead and more properly introduce you. The gentleman we have with us is Dr. Santos Vega. He is a PhD. He taught and directed education programs for over 40 years, and he's a professor emeritus in Hispanic Research Center at Arizona State University. He also served in the U.S. Air Force during the Korean War and raised his family in Arizona, and he's married for the second time, happily, since 2002, and he is also a life-professed Order of Preachers laity at the Newman Center in Tempe, Arizona. He also has a number of other degrees, but the primary reason he's joining us tonight is because he has written and published a book, and this actually was published a while back, wasn't it?
In 2007.
Santos? Okay, that's a couple of years ago. Yeah.
2007.
Right. And the book is called The Worm in My Tomato, which is a novel, but as I understand it, it's based on an experience that your family, among others, had occurred to them. Is that correct?
That's true. It's based on the true experience of my family.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we talk about the novel per se, why don't you tell us what happened with your family? This was during the Depression, I think you had told me.
Yes, the Depression of 1929, and it mm-hmm. never ended until we got into the war in 1942.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were all U.S. citizens. My mother was third generation, and all the siblings were fourth generation. I'm fourth generation Arizonan.
Right.
And so the only one in the family that was not a U.S. citizen was my father. He was from Mexico, Sinaloa, Mexico.
Right.
And he had
right.
worked here for 38 years in the United States. But during the Depression,
right.
there began to come up laws in the county and state governments and federal governments that really put an impinged upon the rights of the non-citizens to work. Like on CC Camp, for example, or other WPA programs, and also not to qualify for commodities or help in any way whatsoever, and then the mining industry ended. The mines closed in Miami, Arizona, and elsewhere in Arizona, and so the economy was bad, and he just could not stay here and get help from the federal government programs that were there, and so he decided to either leave the family here, return to Mexico, or take the family with him. And my mother had to make that decision. And because
okay, before you go on, Santos, I wanted to explain. You used a couple of acronyms. For those who don't know, you were referring to some Depression era programs that were designed to relieve the situation for folks, and you referred to the CCC, which was the Civilian Conservation Corps, and the WPA, which was the Works Progress Administration, and those were both designed, were they not, to provide work to folks who otherwise couldn't find it.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So
and,
you were
and
starting
so,
to. You were. Go ahead. Go ahead and tell us what you were telling us, please.
Well, my mother had to make the decision of either keep the family together or separate the family, and she decided to keep the family together, and so we then had to go with my father, and they had a program called repatriation program. That differs from deportation, because deportation goes to the court system, and repatriation is voluntary, and so my father decided, and my mother, to take the family, and we loaded up on the trains. They provided trains from all over the country, and from the Midwest to California, and these trains took Mexicans back to Mexico during this repatriation program, and we left 1932.
I see.
And so my book tells that story, how we left, and the cover has a real picture, genuine picture of the time, of the train, and the people loading up on the train, and then how we survived in Mexico, and how we returned back.
It's amazing. It's an amazing story. Let me ask you, how did you get the title? What made you think of the title, The Worm in My Tomato?
That actually, in the book, is an actual incident that happened when my sister Lorena was very much, we were very poor and had nothing to eat. Our store was a desert, and we were lived on the desert plants and animals. And so this day, my father was a farmer now, and growing tomatoes, and had given Lorena her own bush of tomatoes. And so this particular morning, she was ready to go and eat her tomato. She had watched it grow from the size of a marble to the size of an orange, and turn colors from green to ripe red. And just as when she was ready to eat it, a worm came out, and so that ruined her intentions, her eating. And so I used that as a metaphor for the whole book, because the siblings were going to school here in Miami, Arizona, and my brother Sam was just about to graduate in May, and we left in March. So we had siblings that had to quit their schools, their education, and so that was the end of their tomato.
Right. I was going to say, it's a very vivid metaphor. When your family returned to Mexico, well, I shouldn't say returned, because except for your dad, I guess, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I guess your dad was the only one who had actually spent time in Mexico before. The rest of you were born here.
So when
the family went to Mexico, you had mentioned that there was a good deal of poverty, of course, because Mexico, of course, was experiencing the Depression anyway, as well as the United States and most of the rest of the world, but it was also a much poorer country even without the Depression, correct?
Correct. And so the family, my mother, that's very much explained as life was developed in Mexico, and my father had to become a farmer, which he was not a farmer. And he was working in construction, and he had also been a gambler and ran card games, so he was usually accustomed to dressing very fine with fine suits, and my mother was accustomed to having a church and a store and a theater and a street and neighbors and people that delivered food and clothing and wood and ice to the homes. But when we got to the rural area of Sinaloa and around the El Fuerte River, where my father and my dad took us, he had some land there from his family, and now my mother had no store, no theater, no church, and no place to visit or no social life.
And no iceman and no woodman.
See?
Mm-hmm.
So life changed drastically, and they had to survive.
Yeah. And so they farmed in part because that was a way to raise food and make sure they could eat.
That's true.
Correct?
They had to learn basic foods that grow naturally in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And even here in Arizona, we hear about our Native Americans that still go out to the desert and get pitayas. And pitayas is the fruit that grows at the top of the saguaro trees in seasons.
Right.
And so from here, they boil it, they make paste, they make spreads, jams and jellies, and they eat the saguaro. And then there's also wild onions, and there's wild spinach, and all kinds of foods that survive on.
Right, and which remarkably survive in the desert, despite the fact there is extraordinarily little water for most of the year.
Yes, they lived near the El Fuerte River, and so they also
used there was the some irrigation.
Yes, there was. They had to depend mostly on seasonal rains, although there was some irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's true. And so
now, no, please go ahead. Don't let me interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, by the third year, he had a crop in his land, and he had raised garbanzo beans and corn and squash and tomatoes and other crops, and he was ready to begin to turn the leaf and pay back his debt to his sister, who had first invested in his needs for seed and water and so forth. And
right.
But what happened was that there was a plague of locusts. And the locusts came and cleaned everybody in the valley out. And so now they were back to nothing. And so eventually...
They had to start all over.
Yes, but he had to leave the area. And he went to a small town called San Blas. And there he became a tax collector. And for a year and a half, we lived there much better. My mother had a home, and we lived there. But he died. And so now my mother had the decision to make. How to bring the family back. We were all U.S. citizens, and so that's part of the story, how she was able to bring the family back to survive in her life in Miami, Arizona. And so the whole book, 457 pages, tell the story.
Let me ask you a question. When you were talking about the traveling to Mexico from Miami, Arizona, in 1932, was this really was not forced, because you had described it as repatriation as voluntary, but were the folks who were primarily the people of Mexican origin, were they being urged by the government or being urged by the local citizenry to go ahead and go to Mexico? Was there any push, I guess is what I'm asking you?
Yes, we have always been, Mexicans have always been the victims or the gainers of the push and pull systems. During the need for labor, we have the pull them in, and when we need them for harvesting crops and so forth. And then during lean times, we have the push, we push them back out again. And from 1942, to help with the war effort, we had the Bracero program. And so we brought in many Mexican labor to help in the fields, and also ended up in working in other areas to help the war effort. And this program lasted for 20 years to 1962. In 1962, Congress ended the program that made the workers legal. But when they ended the program, they left the workers in the lurch and the employers in the lurch with nowhere to go. But no one changed the situation. There was still need for workers and still work to be done, but now they didn't know how, they had no process to do it legally. And so right away, from overnight, they went from being legal to illegal.
Right.
And the employers are now even fined if they have sanctions against employers, but the need for employment still exists.
Well, the need for employment from the workers' standpoint, and also the need for people to produce the goods and services at low cost. The thing you hadn't mentioned yet, because we haven't talked long enough, is that whether it was under the Bracero program or other legal programs in terms of the pull, the fact is that the folks who have come to this country, whether legally or illegally, tend to be among the lowest paid workers in the country.
That is correct, but it's relevant. For example, if you have people by the thousands in the rural areas of Mexico that have no work and have poverty, and they either have to make a choice: you stay here in Mexico with the oppression of poverty, or do you go and seek work in the land of opportunity where there is work? And so many, they cross over to work, and that creates family separation. And so that's one of the great problems.
No, absolutely. And the fact is that, being very low paid here, or being not paid at all in Mexico isn't really much of a choice if you have the opportunity to come over and get paid here. Even though it's low pay for here, it's not low pay in Mexico.
That is correct. And one thing is that many times we cut off the hand, so to speak, in order to save,
right.
Or cut off our face in order to save our nose or something like that.
Or vice versa. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes.
We have a situation where if the crops are not picked, then the crops will not make it to the canneries and to the retailer shippers and the warehouses, won't make it to the stores. And so if you follow just with the orange, for example, all the way through, there's a lot of workers that are working that are not Mexicans. They're U.S. citizens because they're in the warehousing and the jobbers in the retail and the stores. And soon you have these great big companies, corporations, that want to hire the MBAs, Master in Business Administration.
Right.
But then there's no jobs eventually. And this is only one crop. And there's hundreds of them. So that sends up the cracks on the bottom of the pyramid, economic pyramid, on up. So soon people can't pay for their homes. You have foreclosures. You have joblessness.
Right.
And they figure out, how did this ever happen? Well, because
we
didn't take care.
Yeah, the fact is, during lean times, you tend to get a large amount of economic short-sightedness as well. And what you said is absolutely right. Not only is there an attempt to push out people, and it's not just a matter of people who are foreign citizens. You have a tendency to send out everybody who looks foreign, who sounds foreign, or speaks a different language, because there is the bias that comes out, the bigotry that comes out during lean times. It's always it's a knee-jerk reaction to blame the foreigner, so to speak. So you get that. But also, what you said is absolutely correct. The reason I said it's short-sighted is because if you don't have folks here who are willing to do those jobs, then the jobs don't get done. And you lose all those other jobs up the line. Or alternatively, someone will work, but they're going to require higher wages and some benefits, and everything at that store is going to cost a lot more money.
That is correct. I was coming on a trip on an airplane, Southwestern, from one of my trips, and I opened up the magazine, the airlines magazine, and I was reading there an ad where they wanted people to open up factories in China. And so I could sign up for their program. I could be an investor and open factories in China that produces goods, which are then sold in the U.S. And so where are the jobs? The jobs are gone. They're in other lands. And here's another case that I experienced when I was working at ASU, and I had students that I hired from India because they already know English, because that's the common language in India. And they were very bright, nice, wonderful students. And they were in the electronic professions, and so they worked for me in my office. But if they wanted to work outside, they could not unless they acquired permission through the H1 or H2
It's H1B program. Yeah.
The H1B program, and that would allow them. But once they graduated, they had jobs in San Diego, in San Francisco, in Detroit, in many places. And what that showed me was that we are importing a lot of the specialties and high-trained individuals, and we're not really developing our own youth here in America.
Correct.
We're not turning out our professionals. So this has to be looked at and studied from all different angles in order to come with a comprehensive reform this year, hopefully.
Yeah, well, we can hope. Let me ask you how it is you came to a decision to sit down and write the book, and how long did it take you to do it?
Well, actually, the book took maybe 20 years or so.
Wow.
Because keep in mind, I was on that train, but I was only 6 months old. But after we returned to the U.S., I went through the school systems and so forth. But I had to interview my older sisters. My older sister Catalina and my sister Lorena, and I had to learn from interviewing them, looking at what happened to us, and I had learned something from my mother as well. And so I sat down to write this experience, in which I wrote it. And if people are interested to order the book, they can do so online from.
I was going to ask you about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. They can go to.
No, go ahead, please.
www.abrazobooks. That's ABRAZOBOOKS. One letter. I mean, one word. .com. Yeah, .com. And that is our online bookstore. Anyone in Sweden, my next runs that.
No, I was going to say, you said you're writing another book as well?
Yes, I'm working on several books because I taught for 43 years, but once I retired, you cannot take the milk horse out of the horse. You have to keep reading, studying, thinking, writing. And so I'm working on about three or four more books and another novel. That's what I'm doing.
But at the moment, The Worm in My Tomato is the one book that's available on your website?
No, Danny has a few other books on the website.
Good. You're referring to your nephew, Danny.
Danny Valenzuela has this website online. And he's not in he's in competition with Amazon. I kid him about that. but we're very small. You were here in Arizona. And we're trying to develop this reading interest and writing interest. So he's carrying more authors that have written very excellent books. And people go and open up that website, and they can see all the other books that are available.
Okay. Now, abrazo is Spanish for embrace or hug, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes,
similar to the word abrazo. Never mind about the language, but the... Again, the website, for those who would like to look at the book, more information about the book, and order it, it's Abrazo Books, ABRAZOBOOKS.com. And we'll mention that again at least once before you leave.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I certainly want to thank you for the opportunity to tell people about our book. And there's
it's our pleasure.
Yeah, I have another book there that I finished recently, and that's called The Mexicans in Tempe. Because in Tempe, there's an old barrio called San Pablo, which was first created at the base of the Butte. And then what today is University campus, ASU campus, and ASU, where they play football and basketball, the stadiums. All that used to be the barrio. All that used to be their fields where they raised crops. And this happened before Tempe, before there was a Tempe. And so there.
Okay. Well, let me mention, because not everybody is in Arizona, that the city you're referring to, Tempe, is where Arizona State University is located, and it's a fairly well-to-do suburb of Phoenix, modernly. And you're saying that. The place where the stadium is and where part of the campus is located used to be a barrio, which, by the way, is Spanish for neighborhood, correct? Technically.
Correct. That community.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in recent years, the word barrio has taken on another, if you will, connotative meaning generally a poor neighborhood of Latinos. Is that a fair statement?
We have always been poor and hardworking. I see that as a pride that we love to work and we love to be poor.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of our culture.
There's a line in Fiddler on the Roof, and I will misstate it probably, but it's something like there's no shame in being poor, but it's not something I would go after. But your point is well made. But let me ask you a question, because this is obviously an area of broad knowledge on your part. When they built ASU, did they force a lot of the people out of their homes and neighborhood?
Yes, this is eminent domain. We still use eminent domain to ask people politely, but then, of course, wave the carrot and then the stick. And the governments throughout the whole country, in cities and counties, wherever they want to build a highway, for example, mm-hmm. if there's a neighborhood in place, they can come and ask the people, please, we'd like to buy your house and your property, and we're going to build a highway here, or we're going to build public institution.
Public, and so right.
Yeah, they asked the people to move out, and then they did, from where Tempe University is now, and the people moved out to other areas. They moved to Escalante neighborhood in La Victoria, and that had got famous because of three of their residents became war heroes, and they were during World War II. It was like the Salmon brothers, but this were the Escalante brothers, and they have statues. You know what I mean? It runs in pairs. And so I wrote a booklet on that barrio, because I write also barrio booklets. And I have one for that barrio, and one for the Habitat for Humanities South Ranch 2 barrio on 16th Street and south of Southern there on Phoenix. Another, because that's what I'm doing now, is collecting the oral history from different localities and writing booklets besides my novel.
And at least that one or two of those are likewise available at abrazobooks.com?
I have the Mexican Tempe book there, and the Abrazo books, and I've been contracted to write the book for my hometown, Miami, Arizona. I write through Arcadia Publishing. Arcadia Publishing publishes this Image in America books, and so I want to do that one.
Terrific.
And so, but we have other wonderful books with Danny that are available that other authors have written, and I can't mention all the titles, but anyone interested can open up their website.
Go to the site. So you took about, you started to say, about 20 years to write The Worm in My Tomato, and this is a self-published book, is that correct?
This is published through my publishing company, which is called Community Documentation Press, CDB Press, okay. Which I anchored it with Bronze Sacred Heart Center Incorporated, which is a 501(c)(3) nonprofit organization. And my main goal here is to work with other writers and help develop other writers so they can write their own books, because you know the old saying, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, and there's no one hear the sound, we never knew that the sound existed. So if we don't write our own history, well, then nobody will ever know we existed. And we have existed for 500 years in the Southwest and have produced communities. If you look at San Diego, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Antonio, you know, and so we belong here. And we have a long history here, but we have to write our own history because no one else will do it for us. And we should expect
that. That's undoubtedly true. And not only that, but if someone else does, it won't be as true to the situation, and it may in fact be what's the word I'm looking for? I guess derogatory. It would be more demeaning. When in fact, if people write its own history, obviously it tells the story of the experience and the history, which is more meaningful.
Yes, but we hope to be honest, because as a researcher and an academic, I always make sure that I write what I consider as close as possible to the truth. But history is a matter of interpretation. We can all have the same facts, but we can interpret it differently. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of other old sayings, the victor writes the history. But that's often the case.
Yeah.
So you taught at Arizona State University for how long?
I worked there 14 years and retired there. That was my last stint. I taught Mexican American history at Phoenix College, and taught the history of Mexico at Phoenix College. And I also taught at the University of Arizona. I taught the Introduction to Public Administration. And I created a course, Mexican American and Public Administration, and I also directed a program there for public administration for student services, and I recruited students for the public administration, the master's degree. And then I went on to Denver, and I taught and I directed a program at St. Thomas Theological Seminary, So I've been I started in Florence, Arizona, in the elementary school system in junior high. So I've hit all the levels of education.
Yeah, I was going to say you hit all the spots.
Yeah, except high school. I skipped high school. But I have mostly been working with adults because that's my major, a PhD in education, but with an emphasis in adult education. So I worked with
that's
the community all these years with adult programs as well.
That's great. And writing is what you're doing primarily now?
That is correct. I belong to a writer's group at ASU Emeritus College Writers Program, and we have several professors that we get together every second and fourth Wednesday, and we read each other's writing, and we help each other improve.
That's terrific. I will confess to you, I'm jealous, being able to have the time to do the writing that you want to do. So, you know, kudos to you, as well as for the book. It sounds like one that should be read when people are thinking about the immigration issue and everything that happens in terms of culture, because culture becomes a large part of it, obviously. It's not just language, it's not just history. Culture is a major issue in terms of how people live in the United States, because we truly are multicultural now.
Yes, we are a blessed nation from all the nations in the whole world, because we are providing survival. We're like the ark, you know, the ark in the Bible story where they got two elephants and two of each animal and so forth, because the flood was coming. And so here in the United States, it's really like an ark, and we're loading up people from all the different countries, because if any country survives, we've got to be it.
The more diverse succeed. That's true biologically as well, as you know. Well, we've been talking to Dr. Santos Vega. I'm going to go ahead and let you go. I appreciate more than I can tell you your having been with us. For those who would like to take a look at the book and the other writings, both of Dr. Vega and other authors, you can do that at abrazobooks.com, A-B, as in boy, R-A-Z-O, books. All one word, .com, abrazobooks.com. And not only can you look at it, but you can also order it and buy it and then read it. You can have all those pleasures all at once.
Yes, thank
Correct?
You.
Correct? All right.
Yes, thank you.
My
thank
pleasure,
you.
Santos. And again, thank you. You were terrific, and I know that everyone who has listened to the show has enjoyed hearing you, as I have. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You take care. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And take care. That was Dr. Santos Vega, and again, the site for the book is, I'm trying to go ahead and do this. Let's see, did that work? No. Are you still with us? No, there we go. We just cleared that line. In the remaining minutes, let me mention the site again, Abrazo Books, A-B-R-A-Z, I'm sorry, A-B-R-A-Z-O-Books.com. That would be a very interesting read, not just if you live in the Southwest, but pretty much anywhere in the country or the world. Knowing about that history, about having to go back to a country that you're totally unfamiliar with because of economic situations and because of where your father comes from, that would have had to have been tough for both him and the entire family. Before we do our endpoint essay, I want to invite you to join us again next week, the 24th. We will be talking about simple life and how to simplify one's life. And then on the 31st, we will not be here, but we'll be back on the 7th as well. So please join us each week at Thursday, except for New Year's Eve. That would be 6:30 Pacific, 9:30 Eastern Time, and all of the times in between elsewhere in the country. The last thing we're going to do tonight, depending on time, is to give you what we call our endpoint essay. Some Christians appear to believe that if you have an objection to hearing Merry Christmas, there's something wrong with you, or you have a war against their holiday. Some will wish you a merry, and if you ask why they're doing it, they'll say they're avoiding political correctness or that Christmas is everyone's holiday. It's not mine. I should give you some background. I was brought up to believe that there were certain things that polite people don't do. You don't ask someone what they paid for their house. You don't push your religion on someone else. And don't really discuss religion with someone who may believe in a different one. You also weren't supposed to discuss politics with strangers or leave gas in public. Now, much of that's changed, but I still think those rules were wise. Okay, maybe not the one about politics. A friend of mine says that store employees should say Merry Christmas rather than Happy Holidays because a majority of Americans are Christians. He's partly right. A majority of Americans who do profess a belief in a divine being, God, are Christians. But the majority doesn't rule in every issue that Americans contend with. If a majority ruled in 1866 or 1867, slavery would have lasted a lot longer, at least in some states like Mississippi and Arizona. If a majority ruled today, it would be perfectly okay to execute a few innocent people if we made sure that no guilty people got off because their constitutional rights were violated. If the majority rules, there are a lot of people who aren't members of the majority on some issue, and they'd be discriminated against, jailed, and deprived of a great many rights, including possibly the right to life itself. This is not Uganda. The majority doesn't always rule here, and the laws on the books and the Constitution make certain of that in the legal sphere. But we're talking about the retail arena. Some people may not like this, but a corporation has one job and one job only. That's to make a profit. So although you may not be happy if they don't express a belief in your version of God, at least if you're Christian, they're not wishing you a happy Hanukkah or a joyous Kwanzaa. They also don't have to assume they know what your holiday is or if you observe some religious or spiritual holiday at all or none. By wishing you a happy holiday, they're covering you, me, and everyone else. They're avoiding offending people who don't celebrate a particular holiday because they want their business, and offending customers is not a way to increase your business. For me, they're wishing me a happy New Year, and I'm fine with that. Wishing me a Merry Christmas, while out of the nicest intentions, is presumptuous and offensive. I'm not a Christian. And if you think Christmas isn't a religious holiday for Christians alone, I'd like to respectfully suggest you might not understand what the holiday is supposed to celebrate. By the way, the people who founded our country, in spite of what you may have been led to believe, weren't Christians either. They were deists. Look it up. So if you want to celebrate Christmas, do it, enjoy it, and be happy. I wish you well. Just don't require anyone else to do it. And if O'Reilly and Beck and other members of what H.L. Mencken used to call the great American bourgeoisie think that's going to war against Christmas, sign me up for the Army. That brings us to our end point. Thank you for joining us. If you disagree, you'll have to wait until next week to call the show and tell me then. And if you want to mark down the number now, it's 347-994-3796. Again, thanks. I want to thank our lovely producer, Autumn Leaves Bushman, the only Chihuahua radio producer in the entire United States. And again, ask you to join us. Please do go, by the way, to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com. If you have a website and don't blog, you're missing out on a lot of business opportunities, and we can help you with that. Again, thanks again. Until next week, we're gone.